This podcast is brought to you by Lannan Foundation and is available at podcast.lannan.org.
Hi. Thank you all for coming. I'm Arthur Zee, and on behalf of Lannan Foundation, it's a great pleasure to introduce Sarah Lindsay this afternoon. After her reading, there will be time for some questions and responses, and we invite you to stay for the reception and talk some more. Sarah Lindsay lives in Greensboro, North Carolina, and is the author of three books of poetry, Primate Behavior, Mount Clutter, and Twigs and Knuckle Bones. A new collection, Debt to the Bone-Eating Snot Flower, will be published by Copper Canyon Press later this year. In 2009, Sarah received the M. Howard and Barbara M. J. Wood Prize from the Poetry Foundation and also a Lannan Literary Fellowship. As one of the staff members at Unicorn Press, she set type, printed pages, bound books by hand, and she currently works as a copy editor at Pace Communications. Sarah Lindsay's poems have a meticulous eye and attention to detail, but more importantly, she has a singular command of language and imaginative verve. In her poems, it's hard to know where fact ends and fiction begins. It doesn't matter, because as Emily Dickinson once said, my business is circumference. Sarah's knowledge of contemporary science is astute and adroit. Her biological details are never cold facts, but instead, they are sensual and help us widen and deepen our imaginative context. Describing a first cell that felt no call to divide, she writes, its endoplasmic reticulum was a thing of incomparable curvaceous length, its nucleus Golgi apparatus RNA magnificent. In Sarah Lindsay's poetry, the natural world is infinitely mysterious and full of marvels. It's a place where ostrich chicks, before hatching, sing through the eggshell, where filarial worms in bloodstream darkness know when it's night, and drift to the skin of their host, so mosquitoes will drink them and bear them away. Her poems can delve into a mythical kingdom, explore transformations in time, and find that an ancient king is reincarnated on a truck farm in North Carolina. In the end, one is not only aware of historic time, but becomes more keenly aware of the immediate moment. In Zucchini Shofar, the speaker says, who made passing time or judge? Do we want butter to endure for ages, or butter that melts into homemade cornbread now? Please welcome Sarah Lindsay.
Thank you. I'm so glad to hear that it doesn't matter whether I made it up or not. Many times that's the first thing people want to know is whether I made it up, and usually the most bizarre things are the ones that I didn't make up. So that's partly what keeps me interested. Thank you all for coming. It's a beautiful day to be outside, but it's beautiful in here too. And there it is. Okay. I have a poem that I've started to think of as my legal disclaimer, because it's the wrong book. It explains that I'm not very good at observation, which I think is one of the first things a poet should be good at. This is about the things that keep getting by me. It's called Look Again. I know how little I know from observation, that the dog sleeping on the rug with pure concentration will be sleeping each time I look up in a different direction, that five wart-litted mushrooms can form on the lawn in the time rain takes to shift from falling to fallen, that my eyes are too slow to track shooting stars, too quick to spy continental drift, and Earth conceals its spin by spinning me with it, that a tree won't let me see its growth, only its height, and that hairs on my head go singly gray only by night. I hope it's still singly. I'm not sure that'll be accurate. I had a really interesting email from someone in England just last week or so who said he was working on a doctorate in poems of polar exploration. And I'd never thought about that as being a group of things you could study, but he wanted to know something about what I'd written, and I decided that was a reason I should read this one called Mawson's Pie. It's about an Australian polar explorer who is a tremendous hero in Australia for good reason and doesn't usually get talked about otherwise. He was, in this case, with two other men, he was looking for the magnetic pole that moves across Antarctica. And it's also about what I read that heroic polar explorers are really thinking about. Far to the north, but all food is north of here, someone is eating potatoes roasted in their jackets and gashed with butter. Someone is tilting a bowl and letting cream roll down his throat. Mawson wakes in the stuffy tent from a dream of steak and kidney pie and tastes his blood. His cracked lips are sealed with blood. Mawson David McKay, sunburnt, frostbitten, hungry. They could stay in their bags and let the magnetic pole walk over them on its unmapped course. They could take three steps outside and vanish into another crevasse, just like the one where Mawson dangled in harness, waiting for rescue, noted the pure color of its bottomless sides, and tossed up ice crystals for study. They fold away their tea bag to use again. They carefully catch and eat the crumbs from their biscuits. Walking on ice that is every wrong shape for their feet, they come at last to a place where the compass needle stands up straight between them. Each has saved the other's lives and bored them near death with his stories. Here, they look at each other like strangers. Then they start back. They speak of hot coffee with milk, lamb chops, buttermilk, treacle pudding. The pole, relinquished, drifts another inch, and crevasses in all directions open lipless mouths. Far to the north, sailors lost in the Southern Ocean and starved for landfall take as their guides wide-winged seabirds that may never fly to shore. See how many things I can knock over. Reading about explorers, sooner or later I have to talk about space exploration. It's come up for some odd reasons. One of them was when an editor sent me some what he called medical photos and asked if I would consider writing poems about them, and I said, no, I couldn't do that. But then he asked again, and so I ended up... I'm a pushover. This one was based on a picture of a burned hand. But I placed it on one of the moons of Jupiter, and that made it easier. Valhalla Burn Unit on the moon Callisto. When Jupiter shields Valhalla impact basin from the light of the small white sun and the streaming particles of its wind, the patients who are able may come and linger in the courtyard with its soothing views of a thoroughly fireproof world, concentric rings and ridges of ice and stone to the black horizon. The patients move with exquisite care, never too close to each other or anything, sipping bottled oxygen, dressed where they can be covered in white cotton shifts and strips of gauze. Even those with eyebrows and lashes appear to have two holes burned in their faces. The doctors who watch them are not old, but their faces are slack and soft as worn denim, each qualified for this post by the loss of an irreplaceable love. They aren't homesick for an earth they could ever go back to. There's room in them now for oceans of understanding, and they see the use for severe burn victims of these conditions. Feeble light, mild gravity, ice-covered ground, no touch of air to dread, no atmosphere. That's why the sky is black all day, which does tend to bother the nurses, the aides, the kitchen staff, the housekeeping crew, all of whom are encouraged to miss their planet, and when they cry, are to do so hunched over sterile vials meant to preserve the healing proteins found in common tears. I was trying to figure out what to do with that poem when I opened a magazine and found out that tears apparently have some kind of medically advantageous chemical in them. It was a wonderful thing to find anyway, but especially since I said, yes, it's the end. here's another space exploration poem that also refers to Gregor Mendel, who did the first work on genes without, I think, knowing what genes were at that point, but yes, I can refer to you for. He worked with peas and certain easily measurable characteristics, like whether they had long stems or short stems, and so that's in here, because it's called Vegetables in Space. In between the launching of satellites, the sipping of orange drink, and the wondering if their toenails were growing faster up there, the men in their glorious repeated arc beyond rainbows tended their garden peas. Round-faced Mendel the monk could not have bent with more grave tenderness over his smooth and angular seeds, his long and short stems, and his beautiful, ever so slightly cooked tables of figures than these unshaven pilots, left without steering to do, over their small and tentative passengers. Plants were company of a sort, something to do besides exercise, and they held a secret. Would noble generations yet unborn, hurtling toward Andromeda, eat fresh peas? Enclosed in their state-of-the-science greenhouse mist, some never sprouted at all. Some broke into tendrils whose spirals wandered in their weakened wits and then lay down. A few, and who knew why, opened their dimpled fists into resolute stems, translucent with a sheen like baby's eyelids, that found their way in weightlessness or the gravity exerted by the mass of a spheroid seed. No one heard them say, "We came so high, but we don't see the sun from here. There must be none." Or, "There is no up. We can grow any way we please." Or, "Which way? Which way? From the food toward the light." There was an early astronaut who talked about how he knew there was no heaven because he'd been in space and hadn't seen it. And I thought that was sort of an annoying thing for him to say. So I made some of the peas a little more intuitive than he was. I have bookmarks. Another form of exploration, of course, that I can't seem to stop thinking about is archaeology. And there's a series of poems in the middle of Twigs and Knuckle Bones where I created my own ancient culture so that I could be the expert on it, and no one could tell me I'd gotten it wrong. But it's obviously based on some of the cultures in the Middle East from, I don't know, a couple of millennia before the zero year. And what I enjoyed doing most of all was having this sort of ability to go back and forth between what really happened and what the archaeologists were able or forced to deduce had happened, which might or might not have been correct. And I have trouble figuring out how to read a couple of them without going on, "Well, this one explains this, and now I'll read this one." But there are two of them that could be considered to go together, and this one starts in the ancient culture. An old joke. Overtaken by the spilling sickness, thousands of years before the drug that could have cured her was bottled, she expelled clumps and puddles of matter her body had need of but could not keep. They buried the husk of her in the front room, tiredly crying. Now that their house and its city have settled once more to ground level, will the dust she relinquished rise on a storm and blow through Jerusalem or Baghdad? Or has it sifted down to layers that don't even shiver at surface explosions? She lived 16 years before the fever closed on her and never spent one second thinking about this, or imagining an apprentice scholar flown from another continent and thinking about it for her. On her last ordinary day, she laughed at a joke, setting in motion the air you just inhaled. She licked honey from her fingers, and they didn't taste like dust. It's hard to write about anything going on in the Middle East without dragging in little bits of the current events, but this one is mainly about an archaeologist there, and it's called Fragments from Rubble. By day, he stares at the ground, distinguishing fragments from rubble, but when at night he cracks his back, he can see overhead as many stars as the people who lived here and called it Iskat and thought of their mud brick cluster as a great city. The nearest city now, across miles of desert, lies coiled around its dragon's hoard of weapons and hospitals, cigarettes, CDs, and water. Otherwise, he thinks no one would ever go there, live where the air is scored with sirens, walk where the sky's intermittent rumble may or may not be the sound of commerce. Here his sleep is a tent of black felt, entered only by dreams. Here he analyzes detritus that matters, if it matters, only because it is old and once intentional. People under a different pole star, under a younger sun, who worshipped a god with a bird on his head and a fish in his fist, they meant this paving stone and this flake of enamel. After a day with his brush in the dust, when he closes his eyes, he still sees unsorted litter. But once, he'll never tell anyone this. On his way to sleep, in a weightless dusk, he stood in the trench whose floor was partly an alley behind the Numis temple, and a thin woman wrapped in woven wool, head high as his shirt pocket, stretched out an arm and left in his palm the little bones of her hand. There's that powerful fantasy of connecting with the past and also of knowing everything about it. We'll never get there, but it feels good to think so. To get closer, that's all. I brought a couple of poems I think of as new because they're not going to be in the next book, so they might be in the one after that. And this one is another archaeologist, but she's working right now, and she's working in Africa. Her name is Sada Mireille, if I'm pronouncing it right, and I read a very short magazine article about her that had one thing she said made me realize that I had to steal it. So this is new because this afternoon I took two lines out of it. But I'm trying to think if there's anything else new. Oh, she's finding ancient paintings in Africa, but not in a cave the way they are in Europe. They find overhangs where the rock is leaning over the ground, but it's not sheltered in any other way. So if you look up, you can sometimes find something. And this is named for the location, more or less, called the Dambalan Animals. They thought they were going to sneak in, but they can't. I'm sorry, I'll just have a seat. No one sits in the front, it's like my church. The Dambalan Animals. I must not tell where they are, she thought. Even while calling to her assistant to see, quick, come see the painted rock. And if a local guardian serpent, 5,000 years old like the paintings, heard, it would have had the same thought as it began moving toward her. No, she answered herself, they need protection. Nomads for generations, said the rock, faces covered with painted animals harbored evil spirits. But how could they fear these leaping, lively figures, yellow, pink, green, red, black, brown, white, and busy, antelope, ibex, giraffe, dogs, snakes, humans with bows and arrows, so small she could cover that sheep with her hand, and the sweat of her palm would ruin it. She lay down in the dust with her camera under the overhang to keep the lambs and the collared pink headless cow and she heard a snake breathing close to her ear. Too soft to call a hiss, the narrow stream of its single lung, and she did not think. A person's death approaches often before the end. She thought venom and saw, without daring to turn her head, the viper's faint smile, its slim tongue lapping the smell of her fear. And she tried to keep as still as the ground, feeling a shiver coming. But the snake withdrew then. It vanished. She couldn't think why. That's when the assistant showed up, ready for wonders, in time to hear her deep drink of air sounding loud and the loose exhalations louder, almost laughing, almost saying, "I'm here, I'm alive." Coincidentally, a rough translation of what the animals leaning over her said. Because that's another thing, you know, I want to know all about what the cave painters were thinking. We've all gone through, well, maybe not all, but most of us have wondered what's going on with the rhinoceros and the bulls painted in the caves, exactly where it's the hardest to find them. That's amazing. But I will now switch to something that's not really an exploration, except you probably count exploring the life of a person you think you know, and this one's about my father. So it's called Good Man. No pickle jar lid could withstand him. In one bare hand, he cracked 3 walnuts, and a flick of his wrist made a racquetball slam the front wall, rebounding off the back. What was the source of his strength? Sheer virtue? Or did his football hero father toughen him up? Was it true love, or the pearly horn of contentment, a beast more elusive than love? Or diet? He plunked a brick on a paddle over and over, one wavy hot day, and flipped it high to a guy on a ladder, his first paying work. That day's dollar went for a piece of pecan pie and a glass of cold milk, he told us, a light in his eye, and for dessert, a glass of milk and a piece of pecan pie. Which is why I had to order the pie at dinner last night. So I did not look at the time I started. This is a kind of an autobiographical poem. I don't usually do that. In this case, it's about how my husband and I got together. But I've changed this into birds that live on the Galapagos Island. Courtship displays of the blue-footed booby. No, you know, it's just the name of the bird. It's nothing. His strut was nothing special, waving the feet high, splatting them down. His flight display delineated a modest territory. Then came the little presence of nest material. First, a thing like a stone with ravines for secrets. A peach pit, he told me. He'd heard its fruit was sweet and soft, with skin that blushed like a sunset. Second, a tuft of long grass bent at one end, trodden perhaps by iguanas, he said, or pressed beneath the deliberate foot of a giant tortoise with shining eyes, hauling sandward her unlaid eggs. Then again, he said, a human might have stepped on the grass, as they step on so much, or crushed it under a box, and we could spend years on the things they put in boxes. But he turned to his third gift instead, a posy of feathers tweaked from his breast. We threw back our heads. He gave the high whistle. I made my low reply. I bowed to my new possessions, swaddled in stories. His feet were heavenly blue. There was this little card, you know, number 49 or something, the blue-footed booby, and it listed all the courtship behavior. And I'm glad you already introduced the debt to the bone-eating snot flower, because I'm going to go ahead and read this title poem. It's about a creature that was discovered, I guess, just a few years ago and named a few years ago by someone with a sense of humor. And we just had no idea of all that this creature was doing for us all along. So this is called Debt to the Bone-Eating Snotflower. We neglect to give thanks to the tender pink plant-like ocean-going worm called Ozodax mucophloris, which has no concept of us, no sense of being recently discovered, no name for herself, nor thoughts on our name for her, in English, bone-eating snot flower. But without her, and the him she keeps for his lifetime in her body, every seashore would be barricaded by skeletons of whales. The tides would rattle, blushing in the shallows where hagfish undress a recently stilled leviathan. The snotflower strokes a fresh white surface, presses against it, eases her animal roots through and into a scapula, a rib, perhaps vestigial pelvis, and eats or drinks or otherwise absorbs the structure. And when she leaves, it's gone. In her useful diligence, she resembles the worms that stir our fields from below, the worms and cousins of worms that tend our woods so logs and carcasses haven't piled up higher than pine tops. And so we can go on gardening, hiking, throwing frisbees on the beach, ignoring the ugly ones, the specialists, minute, nocturnal, or hidden from light, the smudge, the slime, the particles in their modest trillions that shield us from excess while ignoring us too, and further, kindly keep their slurps and snips and whisks and hooverings from evolving beyond the sky, where they might tidy away dark matter and leave us sleepless under unbroken sheets of stars. I'm kind of an expert on things being messy. One of the things I've particularly enjoyed about this invitation is getting to stay in a clean apartment with no books on the floor until I put them there. And I get to sit there with no schedule yesterday, eating fresh raspberries and thinking, this is because I write poems. It was wonderful. I really enjoyed this. I think I'll read the poem with the endoplasmic reticulum in it. That was a phrase that I learned probably in junior high school, and for years and years I wanted to get it into a poem. And finally just had to push it all together. But I was thinking about the earliest life back behind the dinosaurs and things that probably got me interested in the first place. And so here's a happy single-celled being back at the very beginning, called Origin. The first cell felt no call to divide. Fed on abundant salts and sun, still thin, it simply spread, rocking on water, clinging to stone, a film of obliging strength. Its endoplasmic reticulum was a thing of incomparable curvaceous length. Its nucleus Golgi apparatus, RNA, magnificent. With no incidence of loneliness, inner conflict, or deceit, no predator or prey, it had little to do but thrive, draw back from any sharp heat or bitterness, and change its pastel colors in a kind of song. We are descendants of the second cell. Russell. I didn't notice when I started. It's time for the last poem now. Okay. No, I didn't really mean for you all to say that. That's the altitude. Well, I'll read a strange one that you also quoted, and then another one. This is just things that I collected and did not make up about what different animals are doing, and tied together with a loss called Song of the Spadefoot Toad. We stand by the patch of grass marked his, but he is no longer subject to the whims of this bewildering sphere with its sound waves, cancers, specific gravity, spring, where we still live, where ostrich chicks before hatching sing through the eggshell, where filarial worms in bloodstream darkness know when it's night and drift to the skin of their host, so mosquitoes will drink them and bear them away. Did he look without eyes once more, as if over his shoulder? Did his old home shrink to a rolling marble, where elephants hollow out caves in a mountain to eat its salt, where ants shelter aphids and drink their sweet green milk, where a black-tailed prairie dog bolts through a tunnel with an infant head and scarlet neck in its mouth? We who still recoil from death, how can we picture where he is now, when we labor to comprehend this place, where minute crustaceans pierce the side of a swordfish to lodge in its heart, where spadefoot toads wake from 11 months' sleep and sing till their throats bleed, where humans do everything humans do, where a fig wasp pollinates a flower while laying her eggs, then lies on her side as baby nematodes crawl from her half-eaten gut, and where faithfully every day in mangrove shallows, paired seahorses, armless, legless, without expression, dance with each other at sunrise. If I can find the junk drawer poem, maybe I should read that too. I could read all of them. No. Well, this one's on top, so I'll just read this. I have a couple of poems, and I don't know why, about the sort of climate change that brings disaster and causes strange evolution that involves whales. And in one case, the whales grow feathers, and in this one, some of the people turn into whales. This is called World's Worst Whale. While others adapted to rising seas, I was letting foam lick my feet, drawing in wet sand, collecting too many shells and mending my pockets at night. I chose clumsiness, an inflatable raft, a fat red life jacket, thinking I had choices. Later, I made a lousy whale, a little too much hair, fear of the dark, sputter and choke when I surfaced to breathe. Toiling near the back of the pod in my blubber straitjacket, I swam like an inchworm. My tolerant companions breached and twirled and dandled babies on their backs, blew bubble rings, ballooned their pleated throats with krill fizz, didn't hate the cold. They marbled the ocean with music like double basses strung with taffy. My song was of longing for words and stillness and chocolate and hands, my capable hands. Should I say after I dropped the pen? But that's okay. The internet can be a wonderful source of ideas, but you have to sort of bring an umbrella and make sure they don't just completely flood you so that you don't know where to stop. But having said that, I don't remember how anymore I came across this something like a 7-second video on a window like this of a snailfish kind of flipping around. And there was apparently a lot of excitement about this because the snailfish lives on a very deep ocean floor, and they didn't really know how it behaved down there at all. It was kind of pretty, and this is what I ended up writing about it. Adaptive behavior. 5 miles deep on the Japan Trench floor, the forecast is the same today as for the last million years. Near freezing, cave black, 5 tons of pressure per square inch, slow rain of flesh. Snailfish ask nothing more. Their plump head bodies are pale with dark eyes, reports the submersible, peering through portals of solid sapphire. Energetically, gracefully, they congregate over a meal of shrimp, waving their ribbon tails. Snailfish bear large eggs, deal carefully with their young, move swiftly in the dark in an ocean of pressure. And here, the observers, so easily drowned or crushed, thought to find only feeble, half-paralyzed creatures. Snailfish move as if joyous. Never pine, fear no grief. They are strong like Staphylococcus bacteria tried for generations by hospital protocols. Strong like earthworms in old mines who swallow copper, lead, and arsenic, yet thrive excreting milder poisons. A snailfish ripples through Pacific depths. An earthworm tunnels under England. and neither bears an enormous brain that must be fed, a hearth fire demanding every tree for miles. Such brains belong to the ones who invented a camera that can plumb the sea in return, and the ones who poured the metal and mined the stone, the ones who mow their lawns, wear shoes that hurt, deafen themselves with music, the ones with bad backs, bad knees, terrible eyesight, who stay up late, speed on highways, don't eat their vegetables, sometimes sit on one side of a bed too sad to pull on socks, and sometimes fall in love like mangoes hitting the ground. The ones who scrounged for grants and skipped having kids so they could be seasick over the trench where hypothetical, solitary, anemic beings listlessly lived, and who leaned toward their video evidence of vigorous fish and made noises of pure delight. Thank you so much.
We have time for some conversation, and so just give me time to pass the microphone to you. Who'd like to start?
Starting is hard.
I just want to say thank you.
No.
I come from a loud family. Poems are filled with warmth and humor, and they are written with such a sense of getting to know a little bit about you, which is so they're very
good.
Generous.
Well, thank you.
Do you teach in Greensboro? Or you
no, I don't.
Oh, recording, so if you would speak into the microphone, you know.
Oh, thanks. Sign language or something. I don't teach in Greensboro, to respond to the second question. I think teaching is such an important profession that I didn't want to do it badly. And I sort of fell into this proofreading, copy editing situation instead that's worked out really well for me. Even though we're working, for a long time I worked on an airline magazine, and everyone seems to consider that sort of the lowest form of prose, but it turned out to be good training because you have to look at every sentence and think, does this make sense? Can it be misunderstood? Is there a way to make it better? So it's been really good for me. Yes.
Do you have a science background?
Not exactly. Apparently, when I was in third grade, I said I wanted to teach science. My father is a math professor, and he was working for a lot of the time I was growing up in Iowa. He was working on an introduction to liberal arts curriculum for everybody who was a freshman at the college where he worked. And I think I just picked up on some of this stuff about not specializing and needing to know a little bit about a lot of things. And I ran into The Lives of a Cell by Lewis Thomas and started reading the books that came after that and just try to... I'm really just a dilettante, but I try to keep up with all the cool stuff.
What you just described about the airline magazine is sort of like the scientific method, though.
Okay, good. That's right, good.
Thank you.
You could ask him questions.
Well, I'm just curious about when you started writing poetry, when you decided that was your life.
Well,
or part of it.
I have a 3x5 notebook from third grade where I was trying to write little verses, and in fifth grade, I found out poems didn't have to rhyme, and that was kind of exciting. But I thought I was going to write novels. And I went to the MFA program in Greensboro and was encouraged to try both, and got to the point where I wasn't able to create characters, it seemed, that, or plots. So they teased me about how short my stories were. They'd be about 10 pages double-spaced, and the poems were coming out. And also, when you get a job, you know, a poem you can actually draft in one sitting, and it, it seemed to be working out better, and so I just focused on that. In a poem, nobody says, oh, that could never have happened. So.
Why did you stay in Greensboro and being in the South informed your way of telling stories and thinking? Do you find it has infiltrated your brain?
I suppose. Well, there was that reference to cornbread in the zucchini poem. But my father was from Tennessee, and my mother was from Illinois, so, you know, that was a mixed marriage as far as we could tell. They taught us so much. And when I went to college, it was in Minnesota, and I vowed that I would go someplace warmer for graduate school, and once I was there, I'm kind of hard to move, but I got the job with Unicorn Press, and that was just a wonderful thing. And after that, I had a relationship, and so I didn't want to move then, and I found another job, and I just settled in. Greensboro is kind of a motley city where a lot of people aren't natives, and you can hear lots of different accents, and so probably the South has rubbed off me less than if I were in Shelbyville attending the Pickle Festival or something like that. It's a congenial place, and maybe it's just hasn't forced me to write regional material. So.
Yes. The first one is, what are you reading right now? And the second question is, what would you like to write about that you haven't yet?
Burning. Let's see if I can keep those straight. One thing I'm reading right now is a novel by Halldór Laxness, who is a Nobel Prize winner from Iceland, and some of his novels have been translated into English, and I think they're just wonderful. And I've also started a book called The Mound Builders, which I think is partly about the Indian mounds and partly about the sort of romantic view of them that developed when they didn't know enough about what was really there. They thought the lost tribe of Israel had come over or something. And I'm reading some books of poems by Arthur C., coincidentally, and Christian Wyman. And there are lots of good books where I'm staying, and I promised myself I wouldn't take them with me, but I have some books at home that I'm halfway through. I usually try to keep a nonfiction book and a fiction book and a poetry book and some couple of magazines, and then usually a biography sneaks in or something, and I'm trying to read them all at once. And as for what I might write, there's a memory test where they give someone three words and have them repeat the three words and then chat away for a couple of minutes, and then they say, by the way, what were those three words? And I want to do something with that, but I don't know what yet. So that's a good question.
Thank you. I also thank you for the reading. It was fabulous. But I seem to remember reading a poem of yours about monarch butterflies.
Oh, yes.
Visiting a site in Mexico.
Uh-huh.
And was it at all autobiographical?
No, it was someone else's story. Uh-huh. I've found that I can do that sometimes, and it turned out that she thought I'd gotten it all right, so that was nice. But a coworker of mine.
Is that a recent poem? I don't remember where it's at.
Well, it's within the last 10 years, definitely, because it's going to be in the next book.
Oh, it is.
And I hadn't realized how much of a spread I had in there, but...
You don't have it here, do you?
I have a feeling there's a copy in here, but it might take me a minute, so if you want to vamp or something...
Thanks for looking. Vamp.
Oh, here it is. I found it. It was, I'm not an adventurous traveler at all, but a coworker's daughter had told him a story, and he was a good storyteller, and he passed it on to me. Did you want me to read it?
Would you?
It's okay. It's called In Angangueo. She was in Mexico for some paper chain of reasons, same way she landed anywhere in her days of plenty. So many languages to pick up, countries to travel through, mouths to consider kissing, and she could walk all day, eat anything, add hot sauce, ask for money from home without reckoning, wake at noon, and stretch without pain. Then after one ridiculously cold night, "It's never like this," the guide said. She stood knee-deep in monarch butterflies and shivered once. Not from cold, maybe from acres of crepe wings, stiff in a low breeze, antennae against her shins. Little boys in drifts of dulling orange were trying to pack balls of wings to throw at each other. She thought perhaps she wouldn't have children. Or guides, like this one who soothingly repeated, "The monarchs are sleeping." Yeah. So sometimes...
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm curious what your colleagues at Base Communications make working every day with a nationally recognized poet, but who is also doing the job of editing in flight magazines. It's a curious combination.
It is. I'm not really sure which is more intimidating to people usually, whether, I correct English all day, or I write poetry. It's just neither one of them really. Anyway, for a long time they didn't know that I wrote poetry. It doesn't really come up in the conversation, but then when my first book came out, I started to mention it more often, and they just seemed to be real pleased about it, and they let me take days off and come here, and once in a while, they tease me about it. And
do they read or come to your readings?
A few of them do.
I'm just curious about the gap, the gulf between the so-called, the unwashed mass.
The ones I work with.
Those who would practice the literary arts. And I think it's wonderful that you can just mix on that kind of an easy daily basis.
I think it helps me. I've tried to imagine going to work and talking about poetry all day, and I don't know if that would be beneficial or not. Maybe I should try it sometime, but I think I prefer to do that in special occasions like this, and then the other days I can just show up and talk about the weather and pick up things that aren't from literary magazines. No one's used them yet that I know of, and just joke about words. And one of the guys is especially a niggler about, if this can be misinterpreted, then we have to fix it. And he gave me a hard time the other day with the copy editor had marked that I needed a comma after bed when I said, "Sit on the edge of a bed too sad to put on their socks." And, his first reaction is, "Well, is the bed sad?" So it's, I'm working with people who are good with language. It's just that we're not all doing it the same way.
Thank you.
So who are your poetic influences, and what's or who is inspiring you right now?
I'd say my earliest influence is Dr. Seuss. But after that, in college, I read some Adrienne Rich and Denise Levertov and got more interested in using Jungian symbols and writing longer lines and not being too formal. And now the wave is going the other way and people are more impressed sometimes by a form. But more recently, Wisława Szymborska, even in translation from Polish, has this wonderful kind of dark sense of humor and a tendency to refer to animals and people as kind of the same spectrum. And I feel so I'm learning from that. My mind usually goes blank when I want to mention somebody I'm excited about. Catherine Carter is someone who lives in North Carolina and has written a book called The Memory of Gills and has a lot of
strange and wonderful things. She was actually raised by biologists in a swamp. And I really like what she does. So. Yeah.
Let's stop here. Thank you for coming. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.